A quick reminder before we get to today's episode, the science Kickstarter is underway. So if you aren't familiar with science, listen to this quick description of the graphic novel from writers Jason Inman and Ashley Victoria Robinson. It's a book I'm really excited about. I can't wait to get my hands on it and share it with my 7-year-old daughter. I think that Ashley and Jason are great writers, and their passion for comics is obvious, and it shows in the quality of their books. So take a quick listen and go pledge and share the Kickstarter with all your friends. Let's talk about your new Kickstarter. What's it all about?
It's called Science with an exclamation point.
So you gotta, say it like that. You gotta say it like science.
Yeah, there you go. You gotta clip everybody's microphone when you say it.
Take care about that, everybody. Wake up.
Yeah. It stars a 14-year-old girl named Tamsin Trecru. It's more of a middle grade story, whereas Jupiter Jet was more of an all age story. So I guess that means it's a little bit edgier in the type of storytelling, but she is attending the Prometheus Institute. And it's the most amazing kind of school that has cute little robots called stats that fly around. It's got experimental physics. It's got amazing labs, but Tamsin's maybe not as happy to be there as she should be. And that's because her dead father used to be the headmaster there, and working there is what took him from her. So she's determined to, take the school down from the inside, like a normal teenager would want to do.
It's Harry Potter if Harry Potter wanted to destroy Hogwarts. There you go.
Tamsin is driven not only by, the trauma that comes along with losing a parent, but her father was a real smart science guy and downloaded his consciousness into her super cool glasses. So she actually sees a projection of him, and he can see everything that she's doing. And he's leading her on this quest, but he can also see like her interactions with her cute roommate, Garen, which is not what you want your dad to see when you're 14.
And the thing is, too, is that her father actually died when she was 3. So she never knew her father. The only father she has known is this holographic version of her father that has sort of existed around her. Science is a story that we think is pretty unique. I don't think there is a sort of teenager-y Star Trek science fiction-y with real facts out there. And if you like Jupiter Jet and you like our podcast, you like any of our tone, then I guarantee you're going to like this. You're going to like our flavor. And you hear about our passion for comics. Everything we do is how much we love comic books. And we inject that into our comics. Like, I think when you read our comics, especially Jupiter Jet and our stuff in the If anthologies and Love is Love, you can feel that love pouring through. And science is the exact same thing. So if that doesn't convince you to buy science or help us pre-order or make this book, then I don't know what will.
All right. If that sounds like something you might be interested in, I highly encourage you to go and check out the Kickstarter for Science. The good news is that in less than 36 hours, the Kickstarter was fully funded. So what that means for you, as someone who goes and does a pledge, you are guaranteed to get the book, right? Like, a lot of times you see something, a Kickstarter, you're excited, you pledge, and it doesn't get fully funded. And you're not out any cash, but you wanted the book. That's why you pledged in the first place. So you don't have to worry about that with science. It's fully funded. And now we're on to stretch goals, right? And if you listen to our previous spotlight episode on science, you'll know that Jason and Ashley, the first thing they're going to do with any stretch goals they meet is add more content, more pages, more story. So again, I think it's completely worthwhile. I've already pledged. Go over there, do yourself a favor, and check it out. Welcome to episode 526 of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is another Marvel Monday episode, and today I'm going to be talking about a recent Spider-Man event from a few months ago. Also, I'm going to be covering the 5th issue of the Charles Soule, Ron Garney run of Daredevil. It's the final issue of the first arc. So a lot to cover. Let's go ahead and dive right in. The Spider-Man event I'm going to be talking about, I thought it was pretty appropriate, being that the Venom movie is premiering today in Los Angeles, California. So we're going to be talking about Venom Inc. And we're going to start off with Venom Inc. Alpha, which is part one of the story. It was a one-shot, kind of bookended the series, which crossed over between the Amazing Spider-Man title and the Venom title. So Venom Inc. Alpha is written by Dan Slott and Mike Costa. It has art by Ryan Stegman, colors by Brian Reber, and letters by VC's Joe Caramagna. So there's a little synopsis in the inside cover of Venom Inc. Part 1. It says, things are worse than ever for Peter Parker. His company has gone bankrupt, and Peter's had no choice but to crash on his girlfriend Bobby Morse, aka Mockingbird's couch, with a full-time job as the Daily Bugle science editor and his Aunt May to worry about. Only Peter's daily patrols as the Amazing Spider-Man have given him any kind of comfort. Things aren't going so well for Venom either. After months in space, the Venom symbiote is back in New York and reunited with Eddie Brock, but its behavior has become erratic and now requires a unique serum to keep its violent impulses in check. In exchange for the serum, Venom has been covertly helping Alchemax, a chemical conglomerate, control their experiments. So most recently, Venom was bonded with Flash Thompson. As the synopsis says, he was out in space as Venom Space Knight. He was then even a member of the Guardians of the Galaxy for a little while. So back on Earth now, reunited with the original bearer of the Venom symbiote, or I guess the second, because Spider-Man, technically, Peter Parker was the first one to bond with the alien symbiote, although he wasn't Venom at that time. It was when he first bonded with Eddie Brock where he first became Venom. So that's where the series kind of starts. And as we see, turning to the first page, it's actually a flashback to the previous week. We're in Philadelphia. We meet another of the heroes who is bonded with a symbiote. Again, this goes to my whole, man, there's just so many of them. But anyway, it's Mania, and she's actually a friend of Flash Thompson. He's been a mentor to her of sorts, and I'm not that familiar with her. I know from reading this that her regular name is Andy, her secret identity, not sure of the last name. And she does also have some other powers beyond just the symbiote. She has the ability to control Hellfire, much like the Ghost Rider or Damon Hellstrom. But she doesn't seem to use that power, feel that comfortable with it. So here we find out she's Mania and she's leaving, or actually she's fighting crime in Philadelphia. And as she's swinging through the city, she gets a call from Flash Thompson, speaks to him and says that she's doing pretty well. Flash clearly wants to get his symbiote back, and it seems like he's reaching out to her to see if he can have help with that. But she seems pretty wrapped up in her own kind of thing. And she hears an alarm, says, Flash, gotta go. I'll talk to you later. She goes to answer that alarm. It's actually a trap, and she is blasted with sonics. And as longtime Spider-Man readers will know, sonics are always a sure way to put down a symbiote. And we see that it's Lee Price, who himself was once bonded to the Venom symbiote, and he wants that power back. And so rather than go after Venom, probably because he's not sure where Venom is, he heard about Andy, he heard about Mania, and he's decided that he's going to steal her symbiote, and it appears that is exactly what he's done. Next, the scene shifts to New York with the Ringer and the Tumbler robbing the Guggenheim Museum. Spider-Man shows up, is able to foil their robbery, but come to find out they're working for the Black Cat, who is the new kingpin of crime of New York. And Spider-Man's not able to stop her because he basically chooses to save a piece of art from being destroyed instead. And by the time he puts it back, the three villains are gone. Meanwhile, he gets a call from Flash Thompson wanting to meet up. And Flash is actually looking to get a hold of Spider-Man. He wants to track down not only the Venom symbiote, but he also tells her about Mania's symbiote being stolen, and he thinks that the two are connected. He thinks Venom is missing because someone's out there stealing symbiotes. Pete's not really that inclined to help. Obviously, he feels like Venom is a bad thing. Venom is a villain, whereas Flash is convinced that he was able to do heroic things with Venom, and the Venom symbiote has turned a corner, and he wants to be reunited with it, and he's missing out on being a hero. He misses that. So Pete says, yeah, you know, I'll do the best that I can, but I can't promise anything. And although, you know, it's great seeing you, Flash, especially considering my, you know, Peter Parker's not really a very popular person right now, and you're still willing to see me. So he does appreciate that. Meanwhile, we see in New York, a truck has, like a cargo truck has been knocked over on its side, a bunch of guns spilling out the back. Looks like the looter was transporting some arms, and there is Venom. So he's not missing after all. Come to find out, he's rebonded with Eddie Brock, and Eddie manages to control the symbiote and keep it from killing the looter, because that's what the symbiote wants to do, because the looter is selling these guns. Well, come to find out, these guns are toys, and the looter sells them to criminals so they, if they get caught, supposedly it's a lesser sentence because it's a fake gun, which isn't actually true, at least not in our country. But anyway, there's a bloodthirsty quality to the symbiote right now that actually scares Eddie Brock. He's like, no, this is not what we do, right? We don't murder idiots. Meanwhile, the looter runs off, and Eddie says, you know what? We're going to need to go back to Alchemex. Your medicine's not working, basically. So he heads there. Unbeknownst to him, he's being followed by Flash Thompson, who, although he gets thrown out by the guards, manages to steal a pass and sneak in the back door. Unbeknownst to Flash, he's being followed by Spider-Man. So the scene shifts to inside. We meet Dr. Steve, and Eddie's Brock is pretty upset, saying, hey, Doc, you assured me this kind of outburst wouldn't happen if I kept my regular treatment schedule. And Dr. Steve's like, assured is not accurate. And Eddie's like, well, you implied then. So you need to fix what you screwed up. And Dr. Steve's like, well, hold on, I didn't screw anything up. So this has been an ongoing research project. The symbiote's a living thing. It's constantly changing. It's adapting. He says, I did anticipate this. I developed a new serum. It's one that incorporates elements of anti-venom, and it will be able to evolve with the symbiote. But he made a ton of it. And Eddie's like, why did you make so much? He said, well, making gallons was actually easier than making a cupful. Plus, we wanted a large sample size to experiment with if we accidentally ended up killing the symbiote. And Eddie's like, what, are you insane? I'm not going to let you try this if it might kill the symbiote. And Flash walks in at that moment and says, don't worry. I'm here now. Nobody's going to harm the symbiote ever again. Spider-Man shows up as well as Eddie turns into Venom. There's a big knockdown, drag-out fight, and the symbiote is literally trying to decide between Flash and Eddie. It seems torn between the two, these two humans who care for it, who have bonded with it before. And Spider-Man decides, you know what? I'm just going to knock over a whole vat of this anti-venom and get rid of the symbiote once and for all. So that's exactly what he does. However, it doesn't have exactly the effect that Spider-Man is thinking that it will. First of all, it doesn't kill the Venom symbiote, and it actually turns Flash Thompson into the new anti-Venom. Meanwhile, at a bar downtown, we see the looter complaining to the bartender about how bloodthirsty Venom was and how he almost died. And he hears a voice behind him saying, excuse me, but you sound like a man we could use in our organization. He turns around. He sees Lee Pace. Lee Pace literally spits some symbiote into the looter's face, and we see that he's become a made man. And it appears that Lee Pace has bonded with the maniac, or the mania symbiote, now calling himself Maniac, and he's able to create little offspring, little spit globules, if you will, and he spits them in people's face, and he's basically able to control them. They're like his soldiers, and they're not fully clothed with the symbiote. They don't necessarily have the symbiote powers where they can use the symbiote the way, you know, Venom does, but they do have the Venom looking face, and they do have enhanced speed and strength and reflexes. So that's how the series starts out. Part 2 is in The Amazing Spider-Man 792. It's from writers Dan Slott, Mike Costa. We have art by Ryan Stegman and colors by Brian Rebert. Letters by Joe Caramanga and Joe Sabino. And I'm going to talk about the art for the first two issues together, since it's basically the same creative team. And then I'll talk about the art for when we cross over to the Venom series separately, since it's a different artist. So this issue starts off, we're back at Alchemex. We see Venom, or anti-Venom rather, Flash Thompson saying how great it feels. And meanwhile, Eddie Brock and Venom are starting to recover, saying, "You tried to separate me from my other half, and for that you shall pay." But he's really weak from the anti-Venom serum, and Spider-Man's basically able to punch him and knock him out. And then Flash Thompson literally grabs the symbiote and yanks it off of Eddie Brock. And then he asks Dr. Steve for a container to hold him in, and Spider-Man's like, "What are you doing here?" He's like, "This symbiote's coming with me." And Spider-Man's like, "Wait, what? You're anti-Venom now. Let's just kill the symbiote and be done with it. It's not human. Like, it's caused me so much headache and killed so many people. I want to be done." Meanwhile, he webs up Eddie Brock, leaves him there. Flash won't take no for an answer, and he leaves with Spider-Man on his trail, saying, "Flash, hold up." Anti-Venom Flash says, "Why, so you can take my partner away from me? No can do." He's like, "Okay, fine. What are you going to do with Short, Dark, and Slimy there?" And Flash is like, "Well, I hadn't thought that far ahead." So Spider-Man says, "Come on, I know a place." Meanwhile, at the Black Cat's Club, remember, she is currently the kingpin of crime. She's looking at the recent spoils of crime that her minions have brought her. And she's like, "Man, these are nice, shiny bits and bobules, boys, but there's nothing that's big enough to pay tribute to the five families. There's a meeting of the five families happening soon, and she needs something big and bold. She's probably hoping to either become a member of the group or at least look like she is a legitimate kingpin of crime for New York City." Meanwhile, Lee Price's soldiers show up, and it looks like we're about to have a pretty big knockdown dragout. Back in Soho, Peter has taken Flash to Bobby Morse's apartment. They take Venom into the bathroom. They're not sure what else to do with him. And, you know, Flash obviously wants to protect him. And Spider-Man is like, "You know, I'm just not sure what we should do with him. Let's not make that decision right now. But what we could do is we could use a part of the symbiote to our advantage." So as we turn the page, we see that it is indeed a knockdown, drag-out fight between Black Cat's minions and Lee Price's soldiers, but ultimately having the added strength and abilities that the Venom symbiotes are giving his soldiers, Lee Price has the upper hand. And, you know, he reinfects Matt Garrigan, the Scorpion, who had at one point been Venom. So he definitely feels, he says, "I'm back." So it's definitely a familiar feeling for him. Back at Alchemex, Dr. Steve uses a solvent of his own design and frees Eddie Brock from the webbing and says, "Hey, you got to help me out. Tell me where the Venom symbiote is." And Dr. Steve says, I wouldn't know when to start. And so Eddie storms off saying, "Then what good are any of you? I'll find it on my own." And as he walks outside, he realizes that he can't feel it. He says, "When I was anti-Venom, I could clean every trace of a symbiote out of somebody, and now that's what's done to me. Our bond is severed. I can't feel the symbiote at all." Meanwhile, back at Bobby Morse's apartment, we find out what Peter had in mind. He's basically taking a piece of Venom and using it to create a spider tracer. So once Peter finishes creating the device, they put a little piece of Venom in it, and appears to be working, appears to be pointing them toward the rogue symbiote. And so Flash and Spider-Man head out looking for the symbiote maniac, and not realizing that it's far more than one, because as the tracker leads them to an abandoned warehouse, they go inside, and once they turn around, they see Black Cat and all of her minions, including Scorpion, Blacklash, Brothers Grimm, the Melter, and Hammerhead, as well as Black Cat herself, and they've all been turned into made men. They're all now working for Lee Price. So that's where the second part of the story ends. As far as the art goes, Ryan Stegman is interesting. His art at times has a pretty big Todd McFarlane look to it. I don't know if he is a huge Todd McFarlane fan or you know, grew up learning to draw by reading Todd McFarlane art. It's not quite as clean or as dynamic sometimes as McFarlane art. But like, especially the way he draws Eddie Brock, it looks dead on like McFarlane, but his Spider-Man looks somewhat different. He looks a little bit more muscular, not quite as lean, but his sense of storytelling is very, very good. I love the way he lays out panels on the page. And overall, I think he's a really, really strong artist. And Brian Raybert on colors, you know, it's very much a primary color palette. It's pretty brightly colored, as befits a Spider-Man comic. It's got that classic comic book feel. So great job in the first two parts of the story by the creative team all the way around. Part three is Venom, number 159, from Dan Slott, Mike Costa, still on story. Gerardo Sandoval is the artist. We have David Curiel as the colorist and Clayton Cowles as the letterer. And it starts off with Eddie Brock in a park. He's trying to concentrate. He's trying to find that link. He's trying to find that string that will lead him back to his symbiote. So he does feel a slight pull when his mind is quiet. He's trying to find the part that knows where the other part of him is. And so he feels like he has somewhat of a lead on where it might be. And he starts to follow it and tries to stay calm and thinks to himself, after he finds his other half, then he can let the hate out. So meanwhile, Flash as Anti-Venom and Spider-Man are vastly outnumbered by not only Black Cat's minions who've been taken over by Lee Price, but also by Lee Price himself. So they do the best they can. Although Flash is Anti-Venom, it's just a matter of being outnumbered. And it doesn't look like they're in good shape. It looks like they may very well lose the fight. Meanwhile, at Bobby Morris's apartment, the symbiote is tired of being trapped in the bathroom. It's calling out for Eddie or Flash. It can't get out. The door is blocked, which seems kind of strange to me. Like, wouldn't it be able to slither or break the door or something? It lashes out. It does break the mirror and then realizes that there is a drain it can go down. And that's exactly what it does. So meanwhile, the minions of Lee Price are trying to just overpower Anti-Venom through strength of numbers because they don't seem to be able to get a handle on him. Meanwhile, Black Cat literally tries the frontal assault approach, but she gets a little too close and Flash Thompson's actually able to kiss her, which the Anti-Venom touches her and it frees her of the maniac symbiote. And Lee Price is not happy about that. He yells at his soldiers, "Get her, bring her back to me." And Black Cat's like, you know, that's probably not for the best. And she runs off. So although Flash and Peter Parker, Spider-Man, have both dated her in the past and they have history, she's Black Cat. She's Felicia Hardy. She's not a hero. She's looking out for number one. She says, "We're outnumbered. We're outclassed. Sorry, Spider, the cat's out of the bag." And she takes off and she literally flings herself out the window a few stories up and she says, "All right, luck powers, I could use a little bit right now." And lo and behold, she has exactly who she needs in the right spot at the right time. It's Eddie Brock. She literally crash lands on top of him and says, "Thanks for breaking my fall, pal. Looks like you're my lucky guy." "Wait, Eddie Brock? Oh, of course you'd be mixed up in this symbiote business." And Eddie says, "Symbiote? Is my symbiote in there?" And Black Cat says, "It looks like it, but the guy in the driver's seat is even worse than you." She grabs his hand and starts running off. Meanwhile, Spider-Man and Flash Thompson are continuing to be outnumbered, and the building is literally coming down around their ears, trapping them. And as that happens in the sewers, we see the Venom symbiote still trying to find Eddie Brock because although Eddie doesn't seem to be able to sense the Venom symbiote anymore, the symbiote can certainly sense him. So as Black Cat is dragging Eddie down an alley, he's saying Lee Price is back, and Black Cat's explaining that, yeah, now he's a cold as ice homicidal maniac. And, you know, he was once Venom, but now he's taken over my whole crew. And I don't suppose you can think of a way to stop him and your special friend. And Eddie's like, stop, hold on. And Black Cat's like, don't you understand? We're being chased by a brainwashed symbiote super goons. What are we stopping for? And Eddie says, because that symbiote with Lee, that's not my special friend. This is. And the Venom symbiote has found him, comes up through a sewer grate and bonds with Eddie. And he's extremely happy. And he says, yes. To which Black Cat replies, I knew you were my lucky guy. Meanwhile, Spider-Man and Anti-Venom have been captured. They're in chains with Lee Price saying, isn't this sweet? Now, what am I going to do with you two? And the story will continue with part 4 in Amazing Spider-Man 793. So the art in this issue, Gerardo Sandoval, his art is a much less clean style than Ryan Stegman. It's still pretty good as far as storytelling wise, but it just doesn't quite have the flair or the finished look. His lines are a little more jagged. His characters are a little more angular, I guess you'd say. And they come across as a little more flat, not quite as athletic and lithe as Stegman's art. But I do feel like the art is close enough in style that it shouldn't read too badly in a trade. And the color work, it's not quite as bright as the Spider-Man comic, which kind of suits the fact that this is, you know, the Venom comic. You would think it would generally be a little darker in tone. So I think David Curiel does a serviceable job. It's not the best color work I've ever seen, but it does suit Sandoval's art. I don't know that the brighter color palette would suit Sandoval's art as well as what David Curiel's art color work rather does. So as we move to Amazing Spider-Man 4, I was a little confused on this one, the way it starts out. It's still the same creative team, Dan Slott, Mike Costa on story, Ryan Stegman, artist Brian Ribert handling the colors. Because right at the start, from the very first page, we see that Spider-Man is hijacking a catering van full of stuff. And I'm like, wait, when did he get taken over by Lee Price? So apparently that happened off panel between Venom 159 and this Amazing Spider-Man issue. So he does manage to stop the two guys who are initially trying to hijack the catering van. But after knocking them out, he webs up the drivers as well and steals it for himself. So he drives off. And meanwhile, back at Carnelli's scrapyard in the Bronx, we see Anti-Venom is chained up to a conveyor belt and he's being fed into a smelter. Lee Price is there with a couple of his made men and they're talking about how hot it is in there. And Lee Price even says, you know, the temperature in here doesn't agree with us. So you boys stay and make sure that our friend Flash here is nothing but ash. And one of the minions says, but boss, it's kind of hot in here. And Lee Price says, what was that? It's like, nothing, boss, whatever you want. And Lee Price is like, I felt something weird there for a second. I thought I was losing control, but it's nice to know this new symbiote and I can never spread ourselves too thin. And he climbs in the car and it turns out he was feeling something because we see somebody watching him drive away from a window. And she says, you're in there. I can tell. Don't worry. I'll find you. But first, there's a superhero that needs saving. And as we turn the page, we see it's Andy. And she surprises the two minions that were left behind. And she says, my name's Mania Creeps, and your boss may have my symbiote, but I have powers of my own. So again, she still has those Hellfire powers. And even though Flash is up to from his knees up into the smelter, it looks like the Anti-Venom symbiote or powers that he has basically created a cocoon to keep him from burning, and he busts out of it. He's still alive and he's happy to see Andy and says, why aren't you back in the hospital in Philly? How are you here and how'd you get me out of the molten vat? And Andy says, well, you know, I still have my mystic hell mark, and that helped me with the symbiote goons and the vat of fire. I mean, come on, I couldn't just hang back in Philly after you told me my symbiote was in New York. So Flash clearly is going to understand that. And she says, once I got here, I could kind of sense where it was, which led me to you. And wait, why are you a color swapped Venom right now? And Flash says, it's complicated. And she says, more complicated than everything I just said? He's like, I'll tell you on the way. Like, where are we going? She's all, there's a new bad guy, maniac. He used to be part of your symbiote, but he turned Spidey evil, and we got to find him. And that's where we are. So meanwhile, at Alchemex, Dr. Steve heads to his lab, and he's confronted there by Venom, as well as Black Cat. And he says, we need more artificial anti-venom. And Dr. Steve says, well, it's not here anymore. It got moved. So they're like, move to where? You need to take us there. Meanwhile, Spider-Man shows up with his hijacked truck, meets back up with Lee Price and says, here's all the stuff that you wanted. Another truckload of supplies, kitchen supplies, waiter uniforms, whatever you need, boss. And he says, there's even some French maid outfits here. And Lee Price says, you know, I wish we had time for you to try to put one of those on, but we're on a clock. And Spider-Man seems more than willing, but then calls Price a party pooper when he won't let him put one on. So meanwhile, Lee Price asked, Black Cat had all these heists planned for her boys, so at least we haven't had to plan anything. But you're pulling her jobs to get her attention, and it might draw her back into the open, and I can bring her back under my control. But so far, she hasn't taken the hint, so maybe you should head over to the Daily Bugle and give them a one-on-one exclusive. Meanwhile, Black Cat and Venom get to the secure location where the anti-Venom is, and they tell Dr. Steve they're going to weaponize it and go on a hunt for Lee Price and all of his made men. Spider-Man breaks into the Daily Bugle meanwhile, and Joe Robertson immediately realizes that he has a different mask on. He's obviously being mind controlled. That's what's causing him to act out of character. And Spider-Man's like, wow, you figured it out so fast. But in the meantime, I need you to write a story, release it right away about how Spider-Man is a menace and he's using the Black Cat's plans to go and steal all these trucks and go on a crime spree. And before that can happen, Anti-Venom shows up, manages to pull Spider-Man out of the building, takes him to the top of the Daily Bugle building where they have a fight that Spider-Man looks like he's going to win until Black Cat and Venom show up. And they basically use the Anti-Venom serum to free Spider-Man from the mind control that he was under. So once Spider-Man's free of Lee Pace's control, he tells everybody that they need to team up because Maniac's gang is actually planning to take out the five families. And Black Cat's very surprised by that. She's like, the five families? And Mania says, and they are. And Black Cat's response is, the end all and be all, kid. The five largest crime families in the world, all of them bound together in an uneasy alliance to respect each other's territories. So that's why Lee Price was having Spider-Man steal all the catering supplies, so he could infiltrate their dinner meeting with all of his men. And he has literally spiked the champagne with symbiotes. And so as the five families all toast to the truce, they all become made men. And Lee Price reveals himself and says, that's right. You all work for me now. We're all one big family. Part 4 is in Venom 160. It's that same creative team writing of Dan Slott and Mike Costa. We have Gerardo Sandoval on art and David Curiel on colors with Clayton Cal on letters. We see our team of heroes having teamed up. They've all got anti-venom, the artificial anti-venom in their own way. Obviously, Flash doesn't need it. He's got the costume. Venom is carrying an automatic weapon with bullets that are filled with the anti-venom. Black Cat has dipped her claws in the anti-venom as well as her whip. The hero Mania has her Hellfire, which there's two things that hurt. Well, three things that hurt symbiotes, right? Sound, fire, and the anti-venom. So it's her job, Mania's job, to watch from overhead and keep them apprised of anything that's going wrong. So they figure there's at least 100 men in there, and Spider-Man heads in because Lee Price doesn't know that he has been freed. He's no longer a made man, so he goes in disguise with some black stuff on his mask and basically tells Lee Price that he had almost defeated Black Cat when Venom and Anti-Venom showed up and they got the drop on him, and they're following him, and so they should be here any time, and it'll give Lee Price a chance to take him out themselves. But the problem is Lee Price then says, stay here, Spider-Man. If any of these heroes get through, we'll see that you, we'll see if you have the stomach to kill them before they can get to me. And Peter Parker, being Peter Parker, can't resist making a joke. And he says, yeah, cool plan. Using me as a human shield, buy yourself a precious 0.5 seconds. And Lee Price says, was that a joke? And he realizes based on that, that Spider-Man has broken free. And so he is immediately attacked by the rest of the made men. Meanwhile, the rest of Spider-Man's team come breaking in through the window. Black Cat, Mania, Anti-Venom, and Venom. There's a huge battle. They manage to free a few of the made men, including Hammerhead. But instead of being on their side, Hammerhead immediately attacks Spider-Man. And the biggest problem is that even with the anti-venom and the artificial anti-venom, they're just so vastly outnumbered. And even once they begin to kind of turn the tide, the heroes are once again put on the defensive because Lee Price says, you're never going to get close to me. Don't you think I planned for this? Don't you think I checked every inch of this place, including the armory? So it's allowing Lee Price's soldiers to attack at range by using automatic weapons. And even with Mania, Andy above on the balcony, raining down hellfire, they're just outnumbered and it doesn't look like they're going to win the fight because they're pinned down. And Flash is trying to talk strategy, you know, we'll move around, we'll flank them. And Venom says, Eddie Brock says, no, stop. You can't defeat Maniac thinking like a soldier. And Flash Thompson says, why not? And Venom responds, because he is a soldier. He'll expect it. But what he won't expect is suicidal insanity. And Eddie Brock and Venom go for a full frontal assault. He basically heads out to the middle of the room, tosses his automatic weapon up in the air that's full of anti-venom bullets, and tells Andy to destroy the gun when it's up in the air. And when she does that, it releases a huge cloud of anti-venom that rains down all over the room and frees the majority of the made men who claim they feel like they've been hit by a train. And Venom himself thought that he was sacrificing in order to do this because he would be right out there in the middle of the explosion of anti-venom. But as the dust settles, he finds out he's whole, and we see Spider-Man has actually created a web shield to protect him and turns to Venom and says, if you tell anybody I saved you, I will lie. So as the made men are happy to be free, Flash is saying, I can't believe that worked. And Black Cat is pointing out that Maniac isn't here. He must have escaped the blast. And she also wants to point out that has anyone noticed that the little pieces of symbiote that were blasted off of these made men are still moving? And Spider-Man says, that's right. They're all heading somewhere quick. We got to stop them. And before Flash as anti-venom or Andy is able to destroy the symbiote, they all escape through a grate in the end at the bottom of the wall. And anti-venom Flash gives chase and says, we've got to find Maniac and separate him from your symbiote before it's too late. But as we see on the next page, it's already too late. Lee Price is absorbing all the little modules back into himself. And being that some of them were, you know, it wasn't that he was taking a piece of the symbiote. I mean, he may have been taking some of it and sending it out. But clearly there's much more in volume of this maniac symbiote than there ever was before. And as Lee Price is absorbing the symbiote back, he says, you know, that was the mistake I made by spreading this around in the first place. This symbiote belongs to nobody but me. And he seems to be growing extremely large in size by reabsorbing all the rest of these symbiotes back into himself. So that leads us to the final issue of the event. It is Venom Incorporated Omega. And it's once again written by Dan Slott and Mike Costa, with art by Ryan Stegman and Gerardo Sandoval working together on this last issue. We have Jay Leistein on inks, Brian Robert on colors, and VC's Joe Caramanga on letters. So this one picks up right where the last one left off. The heroes are running outside trying to track down Lee Price. And Mania is on the roof, and she tells everybody it's on the ground over there. And as they turn to look, we see that Lee Price has absorbed all of the other symbiotes, all of the little maniac globules that he had spat on all of his made men, and he's grown to an enormous size. He's at least, I don't know, 10 times the size of Venom. So the heroes immediately attack, but just based on the sheer size of him, they're not having much luck, even with the anti-venom. And when Flash tries a full frontal assault, Lee Price says, you know, your touch may be toxic to me, but it doesn't apply to this tree. And he lifts a tree out of the ground and smashes Flash with it, literally bats him like a baseball into the side of the house, and a good chunk of the house collapses on top of him. So it's likely that Flash is dead based on the impact and the amount of trauma. So Venom tries his hand next. Doesn't seem to have much more luck. Neither does the Black Cat. And in fact, despite Maniac saying his mistake was spreading the symbiote around, he does try to get the Black Cat back on his side. But what he discovers is that, or she discovers rather, is that because she had been made a made person before and then found a way to reject it, whatever is in her blood keeps the symbiote from bonding to her again. So once you've gotten out of your slave mask, can't go back. So Mania decides that she can't do any more good on the roof, and she jumps down to join the battle proper, shooting Maniac with her Hellfire up close and personal. But again, it's not enough to do damage to him. He's just too big. Meanwhile, Spider-Man has dug Flash out, and Flash is kind of on his last legs. He's ready to give up. Spider-Man gives him somewhat of a pep talk, but also in doing so talks about how special Flash is inside, which reminds Flash that, yeah, there is something special inside me. It's the anti-venom, and it can heal any wound. And so he heals himself up pretty quickly, and they go to join the fight. We see that Andy is standing toe-to-toe with Lee Price, while Black Cat has her noose wrapped around his neck. And Lee Price says, you know, even though you dip that whip in anti-venom, it's about as useful as a sunburn to me. And it just doesn't look like any of these heroes are going to be able to stop Maniac. He's just too big. He's just too powerful. Venom manages to gouge his eyes out, but then gets tossed a long distance away. Flash Thompson, as anti-venom, has dug deep and launches a couple of blasts of anti-venom through Maniac's back. But again, it's just not enough to stop him. So as Spider-Man is trying to come up with a plan, Venom is knocked out cold, and Black Cat's like, you know, I might know this thing's one weakness. People who've been possessed by it can't be taken over again. Maybe there's some antibodies in our blood. And Spider-Man says, our blood? Oh, cool. Here I was worried I had been filling up my suit with it for no reason. So clearly Spider-Man's hurting and bleeding, and He dives over to where Flash Thompson is. He explains Black Cat's plans. He scrapes some blood off of himself into his palm and grasps hands with Flash Thompson. And the anti-venom costume is able to mimic the antibodies in Spider-Man's blood. And now that Venom is conscious again, him and Spider-Man web up the giant maniac as much as they can. And before he can break through, Flash stabs Maniac in the chest, and the symbiote explodes off of Lee Pace. Not completely. It looks like he still has some attached to him. And he even tries to spit some in Flash Thompson's face, but it does no good. So despite his better judgment, Spider-Man lets Black Cat and Venom go. He's like, you know, you guys really helped out today. And even though I consider you criminals, I'm so jacked up right now and so tired, I probably couldn't stop you if I wanted to anyway. So they head off in their separate directions. Meanwhile, Flash and Mania have their goodbyes as Mania plans to head back to Philadelphia and still be a hero, just using her Hellfire powers now. That not sure what's up with Maniac. Again, most of it was destroyed, but it looks like some of it's still bonded with Lee Price, and clearly they're going to take him to the vault or some other super secret secure space or place where they take supervillains and lock them up. They say as much in the issue. And Flash Thompson, anti-venom, encourages Spider-Man to take off. It says, before my military contacts get here, you should probably get out of here. And Spider-Man says, what about you? To which Flash responds, well, one of us has ties to the government and the other is a known vigilante. Spider-Man says, good point. I will see you around. So he heads back home to Bobby Morris's apartment, and she has just returned as well. And they have a bit of a reunion. And as Bobby says, hey, let me show you a little appreciation, but I need to freshen up first. And she heads into the bathroom, and that's when Pete remembers that that's where the symbiote had been, and says, the bathroom, Bobby, wait. But she goes in, she finds it thrashed, screams out, Parker! And Spider-Man says, yeah, I wouldn't touch anything. There could be alien residue there, but I know a guy, Dr. Steve, who might have some anti-goo stuff to clean it up. So I'll be right back. Bye. And he swings off. Meanwhile, we see Black Cat back at her headquarters, lamenting that she has to start over. You know, she had been working her way up to be the new kingpin of crime of New York. Now she's lost all her minions. She's lost her headquarters. She's lost all the valuables that she has. And unbeknownst to her, Venom is there as well and reveals himself and says, you should think of this as a fresh start. Right? You don't need anyone else. Just trust yourself. And did you really want to be some crime boss pulling jobs, benefiting from theft and murder? You know, we just risked our lives stopping a man who was doing that. So you have the chance to start over. And weren't you always a lucky person? Now you can follow our code, punish the people who deserve it, and protect the innocent. After all, Cat, the city always needs heroes. So Venom's basically saying to her that think of this as a good thing. Think of this as your luck power manifesting itself and take it as a sign. And that's where the event ends. So I've actually read this event 3 times. I read it as it was coming out, and then I read it after it had all come out, where I could read them all closer together rather than spaced out over a few weeks or whatever. And then I read it right before I was going to sit down and talk about it for this episode. I did like it better each time I read it. The first time I thought it was just okay. One thing that's interesting is it very much is a Venom story, right? A story about symbiotes. I still think there are too many symbiotes in the Marvel Universe. I still think they did this because of the Venom movie. A lot of things are changing with Venom right now, with Donny Cates' story that he's currently telling in the Venom series. But as a snapshot in time, as the last Venom story of Dan Slott, as a new status quo for Venom, with the Venom symbiote moving from Flash Thompson back to Eddie Brock, but still wanting to appease those fans of Flash Thompson and the Venom Space Knight, whatever. You know, Flash gets his own superpowers and his own anti-Venom suit in here. So that worked for me as well. I love the fact of Flash Thompson as a hero. I love him being friendly with Pete rather than that antagonistic relationship they had back in high school. I think all that's great. This isn't the most memorable event, and you know, the art is better than average on the Ryan Stegman issues. I feel like the Gerardo Sandoval, it's just not my particular style. I'd say it's average, but I think overall this is a really fun event. It's relatively self-contained. You can just read these six issues and kind of understand what's going on. You don't need to go out and buy a bunch of different tie-ins or lead-ins or crossovers or whatever. So all in all, I would recommend it if you're a fan of Venom. If you're not a fan of Venom, then you're probably going to want to skip it. I think that you could read the Spider-Man issues just as part of an ongoing Spider-Man read and be entertained by them enough. I don't know that you would need to get sucked into the whole Venom Inc. event. So overall, like I said, solid, not groundbreaking, but it is a fun event. The highlights for me are the Spider-Man Flash Thompson or Spider-Man anti-Venom dialogue. The banter that they have back and forth is really where Slott gets to shine as far as his scripting goes. It's done really, really well. And the Ryan Stegman art, I think, again, is really beautiful. Venom is not – this is very much a team event. You get probably get equal time between Spider-Man, anti-Venom, and Venom. Maybe even a little more Spider-Man and anti-Venom than Venom himself. And it doesn't – you've got to kind of read between the lines in as much as – yes, if you're not familiar with these characters, you could pick up these six issues, read it, and enjoy it, but you wouldn't have that deeper understanding that goes with being a longtime Venom fan and understanding how Eddie Brock has a certain code of honor and a certain way that he does things, and the Venom symbiote has picked up on those things, and if anything, it's only had its heroic tendencies enhanced by having been bonded to Flash Thompson at one point. So I think all that feeds into it. It is interesting, though, that Eddie Brock is having a hard time controlling it when the story starts. So you kind of wonder what that's all about. And I have no idea if Donny Cates picked up on that or used any of that in his recent Venom series, because I haven't read any of it, to be honest with you. So all in all, I think it's a solid event, like I said, and worth checking out if you're a Venom or a big Spider-Man fan. So up next, I want to talk about Daredevil number 5. This is the final issue in the first arc of the Charles Soule, Ron Garney version. We've got Charles Soule writing, Ron Garney as artist, and Matt Milla handling the colors. And if you remember what's been going on in Daredevil, Matt Murdock has become a prosecutor, an assistant district attorney for the city of New York. But unfortunately, his grand jury indictment of Ten Fingers, who is a crime lord who's masquerading as head of a church, which is actually more of a cult, Matt wasn't able to secure that indictment because he lost his witness. So he's kind of in the doghouse. He's supposed to be doing night court in New York for the district attorney's office. We also saw in issue 4 that Blindspot was confronting his mother, Blindspot being Daredevil's new protege. I won't say sidekick because he's more than that. He's more mature than that. But his mother is working for Ten Fingers as one of his enforcers. And Blindspot himself was posing as a follower, hoping to free his mother. And we see him in issue 4 reveal himself to his mother as Blindspot to try to get her to leave Ten Fingers. Because Ten Fingers was previously associated with the Hand. He stole a lot of power from them, went out on his own, and now he's trying to establish his Church of the Sheltering Hands. and basically preying on the people of Chinatown in New York. So we saw on the last page of last issue, after Blindspot had revealed himself to his mother and pleaded with her to leave Ten Fingers cult, that something, some monster from the hand was unleashed. And that's where this issue 5 starts. So on the balcony above the main floor of the church, Blindspot's mother saying, "What is that?" And Blindspot says, "You already know, Mom. It's the hand. They're back just like we warned you, and they aren't finished with Ten Fingers." So then Ten Fingers appears behind Blindspot and his mother, informing them the thing down on the floor of the church is called the Fist. It's a half-dead beast infused with evil energy, and it takes a lot for the hand to create one of these. They've got to kill 100 of their normal followers to create one fist. So it's the great ending, and it's been sent there to kill Ten Fingers. Meanwhile, his followers are trying to stop it as best they can, and they're being slaughtered. Blindspot's mother says, "What do we do, Ten Fingers? Do you want me to take the other enforcers and destroy the creature?" And his response is, "Why not take your son? Because he just revealed himself as Blindspot, our enemy. But we'll address that later. For now, I want you to simply watch. I've had the temple doors sealed. All must bear witness. I will be the one to save us. I'm rightly their savior, and I hold them all in my hands." Meanwhile, Blindspot has texted out Daredevil, the temple, to all his followers. Apparently, he has quite the social media following, and he asks all of them to retweet all of that out. Or, I mean, it's not Twitter, but the message is repeated over and over and over. And as Matt Murdock is heading to Night Court, he hears that phrase over and over, "Daredevil the Temple, Daredevil the Temple, Daredevil the Temple." Even one of his paralegals whispers it, and he says, "Excuse me, can I ask you why you just said that?" And her response is, "Follow Blindspot on Twitter." Actually, I guess it does say Twitter right there. And he just asks all of his followers to say that, to say it out loud, to say the words, "Daredevil the Temple." And she says, "It's pretty neat. It makes me feel part of the whole scene. You know, as close as I'll ever get." And Daredevil Matt Murdock thinks, "Blindspot, you're a genius." And he runs off telling his paralegal to cover for him. And she says, I'm a paralegal. I'm not an attorney." And Matt thinks, "Well, this is going to bite me in the ass. Oh, well, I mean, what can he do? He's Daredevil first, right?" So meanwhile, back at the temple, Ten Fingers has grabbed a couple of specially made firearms, and he's firing at the fist, but it's of no use. And once he realizes he's way overmatched, he literally throws some of his power to his congregation. And the fist then turns to attack them. It's not drawn to Ten Fist himself. It's drawn to the stolen power of the hand. And Ten Fist himself clearly would be willing to sacrifice members of his congregation more so than himself. And so right as the fist is about to kill some of these innocents, Daredevil shows up and manages to keep it from slaying them. And Daredevil's thinking to himself that Ten Fingers touched these people with the power he stole from the hand. He must have known the fist would head straight for them. He's literally using them as a diversion, a sacrifice. So he yells at all the people to run and thinks to himself that he's never fought one of these fists before, but he's heard of them. And it's a corpse engine. It takes enormous power. He doesn't know if it can be killed or if he can kill it, but at least he doesn't have to worry about hurting any innocents. So that, you know, it's not alive. He doesn't have to hold back. So as Ten Fingers beats a hasty retreat, he sees his lieutenants coming down the stairs, including Blindspot's mother, and tells them, "You need to kill them all." And they say, "The fist? Daredevil?" And Ten Fingers' response is, "No, you idiot. Them, the congregation, they saw everything. They saw my failure. They all have to die. We will begin again somewhere new." Because Ten Fingers knows that this congregation now knows they've been lied to, that he's not super powerful, that he's not going to be able to protect them. So as Blindspot is helping the congregation evacuate, he takes them downstairs to the basement where he tells them to hide. And one of the men turns to him and says, how do we know that we'll be safe down here? Ten Finger said we'd be safe, and he clearly lied to us. And Blindspot says, because I'm one of you, I live in this neighborhood, I know you, you're Mr. Chen, you run the bodega, and Chinatown is my home, and I'll keep it safe. And most of all, because I am Blindspot, and I am not lying to you. And so as Blindspot closes the door to the basement behind them, he turns around, he sees his mother and two of the other of the eight, Ten Fingers lieutenants there, and Blindspot's mother says, you did lie to them, Samuel. You can't keep them safe. No one can. The order has been given and they all must die. And Blindspot says, you know, the whole time I really only wanted to save one person, but you don't seem all that interested in being saved. So you know what? You want to go down there? You want to kill them all? Your son is standing in your way telling you no. Try and I'll fight you with everything I have. I am Blindspot and I am not lying to you. Meanwhile, back upstairs, Daredevil continues to fight against the Fist while Blindspot is taking on the three lieutenants, including his own mother. In Ten Finger's office, he's packing up all the cash he has and some weapons, saying, I was chosen. I'm a savior. I'll escape and start over somewhere else. And he hears a voice from behind saying, that's beautiful. You're beautiful. But there's always room for improvement. Meanwhile, Daredevil manages to separate the Fist's head from his neck and defeat him. And he goes running upstairs to Ten Fingers' office. And when he opens the door, he sees Ten Fingers hanging from the ceiling. His arms and his legs, for the most part, have been removed. And he's clearly dead. In the basement, it looks like Blindspot is about to be defeated. His powers are no longer working. He's no longer invisible. And he's struggling to get back to his feet. And as he does, his mother stabs the other two lieutenants through the back. And Blindspot's very surprised by this and says, Mom, why did you? And she says, because I believed you. Next time I might not. Your mother is dead, Samuel. Don't ever try to save me again. So it looks like the heroes have won for the most part. Daredevil realizes that Blindspot lied to him, or at least he admitted a very important piece of information, but ultimately he decides not to call Blindspot on it because if anything, he's a Murdoch and he can understand why Blindspot did what he did, and he is not really in a place to judge somebody else for their family or for keeping secrets. So Blindspot says, well, we're done then. And Daredevil's response is, done? No, my friend, there's no such thing. You think this is the last time at Chinatown we'll need your help? No, this job doesn't end. That's the best thing about it. But it is the end of the first arc as we see the NYPD and ambulances showing up to help the injured from Ten Fingers congregation. So I imagine next issue, we may find out exactly what happened to Ten Fingers, who was behind her or his demise, rather, because we do get the tease in the back of the issue that Daredevil 6 is called the Electric Connection, and we see Elektra on the cover. So it very well may be that Elektra is working as an assassin for the Hand once again, and she's the one who took out Ten Fingers. I'm also very curious to see what the consequences are for Matt Murdock skipping his first night of night court. That there's no way that's going to go over well with the DA and more Blindspot. I'm really liking this character. I'm enjoying his kind of more mature. I hesitate to call him sidekick, but it's that more mature relationship where it's much more mentor student between him and Daredevil rather than, a kid who's kind of learning the ropes and doesn't have a sense of who he is on his own. If I had anything to complain about the issue, it did feel just a little bit anticlimactic, being that Daredevil technically wasn't the one that defeated Ten Fingers after Ten Fingers was the kind of the big bad for this first arc. But I do like the story for the most part. I think Charles Soule is using some really fun and interesting ideas. I mean, the idea of having Blindspot text out Daredevil the Temple to all his followers and ask them to say that out loud. It's just brilliant. It's brilliant. As far as the art goes, it's more of, I think I've talked about this before with Garney's art. It's not as clean as I've seen Garney's art be in the past. And I don't know if that's because he's inking himself here or not. Also, the color palette by Matt Milla is very subdued. It's very urban and kind of dirty and street, a lot of grays and blacks and reds. So it gives the book a very distinct feel, and it makes it feel very visceral. It doesn't necessarily feel like a superhero comic. And I don't know if that's the tone that Charles Soule is going for. If it is, then clearly they've succeeded very, very well. But I do know that some longtime Daredevil fans jumped off right after the first arc because they felt that it was moving a little too slowly. They didn't really like the look of it. It's quite a departure from what's come before by Brian Michael Bendis and Mark Waid. Although I think that art-wise, Garney's art is more similar to Chris Samnee than not. So all in all, I like the series. Daredevil's not one of my favorite characters especially, but being that it's Charles Soule, I'm going to be on board because I'm a huge Charles Soule fan. So I do plan on hopefully talking to Charles this coming weekend at New York Comic Con, specifically about this first arc of Daredevil. Now that this first arc of Daredevil, since we've covered it, and then also about his run as a whole and how he feels about it now that it's been announced that it's winding down with the death of Matt Murdock. So stay tuned for that. Hopefully I'll have that for you guys next week, if not the week after. So once again, I want to thank everybody for joining us. Please tell your friends about us. Subscribe and rate us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or whatever platform you use. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on iTunes. Also, all past episodes of the podcast are available on all those platforms, as well as at lrmonline.com. While you're at the site, please check out all the other pop culture coverage of your favorite upcoming movies and TV shows. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, I want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.